Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm thrilled to be here in Denver. This is day number one of the book tour, and it's a thrill for me to start right here at Tattered Cover Book because it's not only a big part of, well, it's Denver, but it's also a big part of literature. And to be here with all the great people who've spoken here is a real honor for me. And thank you, Heather, for inviting me. I was going to tell you a story from Dangerous Animals Club. I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to wing it, as they say. I think it'll be close enough. Because if you don't know what I do, I tell true stories that happened to me in my life. And this story began about 14 years ago. I was out in my garden digging a hole, trying to plant something that wouldn't die. And my then 4-year-old son, William, came running out of the house with great urgency and saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, what is the difference between a person and a cat?" And I answered, "Blue jeans and a license to drive," which I regret. I regret it was a terrible. It was a terrible answer. I mean, it's an oversimplification. There are very many differences: climbing the drapes, drinking out of the toilet. But then it dawned on me that at the age of 4, my son William was actually asking a very profound question. I think he was asking what is the difference between man and the other animals. What is it that makes a human being human? So I was stuck with the difficult proposition that all parents are stuck with sometimes when their children ask good questions. I had to come up with a good answer. So I thought back, what is the difference between man and the animals? There are a lot of answers I heard over the years. I had one professor when I was in college. This was a popular answer back in the 70s, that man is the only animal that uses language. I don't know about that one. Not sure about that one. With all due respect to the good professor, he was not aware of the mockingbird that lived outside of our house in Los Angeles. This bird imitates the sound of everything up and down our street, including a car alarm. I mean, the bird imitates a car alarm. So I go in and look in the bird book and see why do birds, the mockingbirds, do this, and they say they do it for two reasons. They do it to establish territory and for mating. I mean, what else is there? I mean, to me, that's a language. Tough talk, sweet talk, you got it. You got it. So there was some scientists in North Carolina that had the same thought I did, that maybe the birds follow this language path. And they did an experiment where they took some eggs from some local songbirds, and they put the eggs in a soundproof room to see if when the hatchlings came forth, they would actually be able to sing. And they could not. They were silent. So the scientists postulated that this means that actually the song had to be learned, which was another characteristic of language. And this was further corroborated when they let those little birds free and they learned they had a melody. So we wiped that one away. There was a second definition that was big. That was man is the only animal that uses tools. Now, I'm discounting the chimps with the long pieces of grass to eat termites. We're not counting that. It's my argument. I can adjust it any way I want. Because the way man uses tools is definitional, which is different. If man is too hot, he can invent air conditioning. If he's too cold, he can invent summer homes in Florida. Man can invent tools that make other tools. And if you add computers to the design end of it, and if you add robotics to the assembly of it, man actually can create a machine that designs other machines, that makes other machines, that makes other machines, and you are that close to being in a Terminator movie. So in the end, what I told young William was that man is the only animal that asks why he's different from other animals. And that answer worked. It was a good answer. It worked until last year. Last year, my wife Ann and I, we went to visit some friends who live in Maine. And it is very difficult to get to Maine. Very hard. You have to order your tickets way in advance. And in doing so, we ended up accidentally traveling during a tropical storm. A tropical storm in Maine. But it was no joke. Tropical Storm Lee was very serious. Half of the power to Maine was cut off. The tops of houses were ripped off. Trees were overturned. Now, my friends, Richard and Julie, they were safe. They were safe, thank goodness. And we were sitting around the table that evening, drinking coffee. And Julie was sitting opposite of me with the steam coming up from the coffee cup. And she was saying, "Oh, Tobo, if you could have been here, if you could have seen it when the storm came, the sound of the wind, the power of the rain, it was awesome." And I thought back 14 years ago, and I had another answer for William. Man is the only animal that can be inspired. And man can be inspired by anything, and that inspiration is boundless. He could take the ocean and turn it into a poem. He could take the life of another man and turn it into a philosophy. He could take that tropical storm in Maine and turn it into endless stories on the 24/7 news cycle. They could turn it into a made-for-TV movie on the Family Channel. They could turn it into a charity for people who had lost their homes, or just a sense of wonder sitting around a table drinking coffee. Now, inspiration is the invisible part of the equation. The visible part of the equation is creativity. So man is the only animal that has the power to be inspired and then to respond creatively. But once you add creativity to the mix, all bets are off. You have what I call an unstable chemical reaction. You can have either a new symphony or a more efficient gas chamber. Now, we've chronicled this chemical reaction, and we call it history. And the one thing that history has taught us, that in the end, we're not a whole lot different from those little birds in North Carolina. A lot of times we don't know we could sing until we're released into the world. Now, I remember with a certain degree of fondness one of my first do-si-dos with inspiration and creativity. I was in fourth grade. It was Texas History Month, or week, or fortnight, whatever, however much time they gave to that thing. And our fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Norton, assigned each student in the class a character from Texas history to do a report on. I got Moses Austin. You know who Moses Austin is? Who is Moses Austin? Which? No, you're so close. He was the father of Stephen F. Austin. You could have helped me back in fourth grade. The thing I knew most about Moses Austin was that he was not in the World Book Encyclopedia. So I was dead in the water. Back then, it was very common for students to write their reports directly out of the World Book Encyclopedia. So I was not that good of a student. So I didn't have the patience to sit there and copy paragraph after paragraph. Usually, if I had to do a research project, I just made it up. So I decided I would cobble together a report on Moses Austin based on events from my life and some of my favorite scenes from Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. So what I said was, Moses Austin was born in a small coal mining town outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, just like my mother. As a child, he was poor, but loved to read, just like my mother. Like Davy Crockett, he heard of a place called Texas and eventually led 200 settlers from the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area to Texas. Mrs. Norton told us that we were going to have to do this report out loud in front of the school on Parent Teacher Day, meaning my mother was going to be in the audience. For some reason, I was not concerned that she was about to find out how similar her life was to the great Texas pioneer, Moses Austin. Instead, I was overwhelmed with my own sense of inspiration and creativity. I was doing my report on the stage thinking that little bit about the 200 settlers sounds a little weak. I should goose that a little bit. And extempore, in the moment, on stage in front of everyone, I said, Moses Austin eventually led 10,000 settlers from the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area to Texas. On the way home, my mother was driving me in the car. She didn't look at me. She was looking at the road. Stephen, where did you get the information for that report? Well, I was stuck. I couldn't even lie. I mean, it was on TV. We only had three channels back then, four if you count the one that only played cartoons and the Three Stooges. So I just said, I think a man told me. And my mother said, do you know what man? Nope, don't think I do. And my mother said, Stephen, in the future, you should always know the man who tells you things. I must have honored my mother's request somehow, because in the future, even when I did not know who the man was who told me things, I knew World Book knew, and that was good enough for me. The main thing I learned from my first little do-si-do with creativity was that the process of creativity is different from the product of creativity. The process of creativity can be a mess. You can ask any obstetrician. The most famous story of creativity is the beginning of the book of Genesis. This is something everybody knows. We all know how God created the world in 6 days, took the seventh day off. We all know that story. I was 5 years old when I first heard this story. I was in Sunday school, kindergarten. And I remember our teacher sat down and held up a big book that had a picture of a gigantic sunburst. And she began to read the story to me, or to our class, not to me personally, that in the beginning, the world was without form. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And I thought, what a good story. This is so optimistic. I mean, there's nowhere to go but up. And not only that, it makes so much sense. It's so logical that God would make the sun on the first day so he would have plenty of light and he'd be able to see what he was doing the rest of the week and he wouldn't make any terrible mistakes. Well, that's pretty much the way I thought about that story for about a few decades. And then I went back, Annie and I, we started taking Hebrew again. I was in my 40s, I guess. We began reading the book of Genesis again in Hebrew, and I realized I had made a mistake. That any of you who know the Bible know the mistake I've already made. And that is, God did not create the sun on the first day. God created the sun on the fourth day, along with the moon and the stars. Oh dear, that makes a problem. Then what was the light of the first day? Well, now this became a mystery. This became interesting to me, and I began reading about it, and I found out that I was about 2,000 years too late for the party. That actually the question of what was the light of the first day has been a subject of controversy and commentary and poetry for the last 2,000 years. It is one of the cornerstones of the branch of Jewish mysticism called the Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah was created by, I guess, one of the early conflicts, a medieval conflict between science and religion, which is kind of unusual because science did not look like science as we know it back then. They didn't know a lot back in the Middle Ages. They didn't even have the World Book. But they did have Aristotle, which was interesting that they had Aristotle. And one of the foremost proponents of Aristotle was Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, who we know today as Maimonides. And in the 12th century, Maimonides had the belief that you could take any contradictory, controversial passage of the Bible, and you could solve that passage through using Aristotelian scientific method. Well, there was another group of rabbis who felt this was absolutely detrimental, that you cannot speak to spiritual truths with simple-to-grasp scientific facts. It kills all the mystery. In a way, they felt spiritual beauty was like going on a blind date, that maybe it's best to be done by candlelight. Shadows are important as well. And so these rabbis started creating another set of writings called the Zohar. And the purpose of the Zohar was not to answer any questions in the Bible, but was to explode them, was to expand them, was to add to the mystery. And their explanation, the Zohar's explanation of the light of the first day, is so ineffable that it could probably only be understood by Stephen Hawking. The Zohar says that the light of the first day was a brilliant spark of darkness. That the original light of the creative was so brilliant it could not be seen. From out of chaos he created form, and from what was not he created what is. And I went, oh, wow, I understand that last part of taking what is not and turning it into what is, because that's what actors do all the time. That's the process of doing a play. You walk in, there's an empty stage, you take what is not, and you add to it sets and lights and costumes and characterization, and opening night, the stage manager says, let there be light, and you hope the light is good. But it's not just acting. You walk out this door, and you take a look at what you see here at the bookstore. This bookstore is a monument to taking what is not and turning it into what is. Every writer who's taken a look at the blank page, hey, take a look at those photographs on the wall. That used to be nothing except light created a picture that came there. Every photographer, every artist has taken nothing, the blank canvas, and turned it into something. And it's every sculpture has taken the chaos and tried to change it into form. And it's what I was doing 14 years ago back in my garden, digging a hole, trying to plant something that wouldn't die. I was trying to take something and make that from nothing. Well, the most creative moment I have, and my theory is that creativity is the thing that gives us life. And I don't mean metaphoric life like art or anything. I mean it gives us life. The most creative moment I ever had in my life had nothing to do with theater, had nothing to do with the arts, nothing at all. I was 25 years old. I was living in Dallas. My girlfriend, Beth, had sent me to the grocery store to buy food for dinner. I was going to get some chicken and Italian Swiss colony wine. We liked the cheap stuff. And I walked into the store, and over on the right, I saw a stand and a sign that caught my eye, mangoes for sale. It caught my imagination. Mangoes were a new fruit in Texas back then. We only knew about them from the movie Mutiny on the Bounty. And my girlfriend Beth had this sort of quixotic sense of humor. And I thought she would love some mangoes for dinner. I'll go shop for mangoes. Well, I had no idea how to tell if a mango was ripe or not. I didn't know if red or green was good or bad, if when you shook it, it was supposed to rattle or slosh. I had no idea. So I'm shaking the mangoes. And while I'm shaking the mangoes, I see from my peripheral vision a man walking up to my shopping cart. He was wearing blue jeans and a black shirt. And he put his hand on my shopping cart. I thought, well, that's just wrong. I mean, I grew up in Texas where a man's shopping cart is sacrosanct. I mean, you don't touch someone else's shopping cart. It's like touching someone else's belt buckle. I mean, you only do it by invitation. So the man, let me just, this man, so you get a picture of him. He was an older man with gray hair, kind of slick straight back, kind of a reddish face, blue watery eyes. He's looking in my shopping cart and he says, I see you have mangoes, the most exotic of fruits. And then he began to cry. This was bad. Even though I was 25, I was old enough to know that there are 100 different reasons on a given day for someone to break down into tears. Mangoes was not one of them. So I figured the best thing I can do was to offer him a mango. Maybe he was drunk, maybe he was senile, maybe he would go away. I reached down into the shopping cart to get him a mango, and from my new point of view, I saw he had a .45 caliber handgun behind his hip. At that moment, my heart, my soul, my brain went blank. I knew I was dead. I picked up the mango and held it up to him, and he looked into my eyes, and he saw the soullessness in my eyes as well. And he knew I knew. He said, I don't know why I picked you today. He pulls the gun around, sticks it into my forehead, and he says, I've just contracted brucellosis. It's a cattle disease from South America, and it leads to suicide or homicide. Now, I'm standing in the store with the gun in my forehead, and I'm thinking, today of all days, it had to be homicide? I mean, just one more turn of the dice, and it could have been suicide, and we would have been out of all this. I'm standing here while he's got the gun in my forehead. I'm looking with my eye, and I see the store is empty. The store is deserted. Apparently, I had been so busy shaking the dang mangoes that I missed the mass exodus when the crazy guy with the gun walked in. The man pressed his gun more into my forehead, and I had the most amazing thought. I thought of Chad Everett. Chad Everett was a star on Medical Center back then. It was a very popular show. It was on at night. It was also syndicated during the day. And on Medical Center, Chad Everett was in the same situation with a hostage crisis. And he said, you had to keep the gunman talking. Well, I had no idea how to do that. But I knew how to talk. So I started. I said, you remind me of my father, which he didn't. My father's a little taller than you are, which he was. And then it dawned on me, Medical Center had a lot of father-son scenes in them. Chad Everett was the brash young doctor. His father, James Daly, was head of surgery. There was a lot of conflict. And then suddenly it hit me. I would cobble together a story based on events of my life and the best scenes of Medical Center, a la Moses Austin. And I began talking my head off. I said, my father always wanted me to be a doctor, but I don't think I ever could. I was a disappointment to him. I felt like I've always been a disappointment. I've always been a loser to him. I've never been able to do anything good enough. I've never been able to do anything right enough. Right now, I was talking faster than a racetrack announcer on Mexican television. I was saying, why is it that people can't sit at a table and just say, I love you, even though you're different? I always have wanted to say my father about how much I respect him, but all we do is fight. All I want to do is be able to tell him I love him. And while I am talking nonstop, what made the surreal so absolutely real was that looking out the window of the store, he's got the gun pointed in my head, I see SWAT guys running back and forth under the window with their helmets on, with bulletproof vests, with their rifles going back and forth under the window. I see the back of a newsman's head talking in the parking lot live from the scene. I hear a helicopter coming down from up above. And finally, the last moment, an ambulance pulls in. Back doors open up. Out comes a gurney and a body bag. And I'm thinking, one's for him, one's for me. Which is which? I continue talking. Talked for about 45 minutes, and then I felt the adrenaline start to run down. I felt like I was going to run out of things to say, and in this case, I thought flop sweat could be fatal. I hear a voice in my head saying, "Stephen, time to do something else. You got to do something else. Do it now." Well, I knew escape was impossible, so the only thing I could think to do was invite the man over for dinner. Now, I recognize this was not a good plan. This was not a good idea. I was saying, like, what time you got? Oh, hey, you know, I got to get the chicken on. Hey, you doing anything tonight? I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm getting a lot out of this conversation. Maybe we should just keep it going. Why don't you come on over for dinner? If you want, you could follow me over there. Or better still, I'll just give you my address. Do you have a pen on you? In a scene that they would never put in a movie because it would be too incredible. With the gun in my head, the man reaches into his breast pocket and pulls out a pen and hands it to me. I grab the pen. I take off a bit of the brown paper sack that the mangoes were in. And at this point, truth, I was so scared and so tired, for the life of me, I could not think of a phony address. I could not. I wrote down my real address, 3431 McFarland. There you go. Here's your pen. Thank you very much. Come on over. You can meet my girlfriend, Beth. Just come right on over. I've got to go now. And now came the scariest part of it. He was standing in front of my shopping cart, the gun in my head. I moved around beside him and started to walk. And then I felt the gun go into the back of my head. And that voice came into my ear again and said, "Just keep walking. Just keep walking, Stephen. Whatever you do, don't turn around. Just don't turn around." And I kept walking. And at the end of the aisle, there was a stack of a display of Pepsi Cola at the end of the aisle. And I was focusing on that. And the voice came in my ear again and said, "Stephen, get to the Pepsis and you could run. If you get to the Pepsis, you're home free." I'm watching that stand of Pepsis as I'm moving with my cart. They're coming up to me. I take a step around the corner of the Pepsis, and I didn't have to run. Because amazingly, during my medical center blather, using that as noise, the SWAT team had come into the store using my dialogue as cover for their noise. They came in on adjacent aisles, and they had their rifles pointed at us the whole time through the food. The SWAT team was all there the whole time with their rifles pointed at me through the food. As soon as I stood around the Pepsis, police jumped over the stacks of food at the grocery store. Next time you're at a grocery store, take a look at how high those stacks of food are. That's where they jumped over, and they had my dinner guest bound and gagged. In about 8 seconds, they had tied his ankles, his elbows, his wrists, had him gagged, and they carried him out of the store like a roll of carpet. I'm walking through the empty store, and I stand at the deserted checkout counter and wait. A policeman comes and pats me on the back and says, "Hey, pal, you can just go." I take my groceries. I go home. My girlfriend, Beth, is waiting there and says, "Well, where were you?" I said, "Well, I was just held hostage at gunpoint." She said, "Well, it took a long time." I said, "I know the hostage thing takes a lot longer than you would think, and I am starving. Let's put that chicken on." That night, we had chicken and mangoes, an Italian Swiss colony, And I will always remember it as the only time I ever left a store without paying for my groceries. But looking back in hindsight, there was another lesson I took from it. My mother said, always know the man who tells you things. Even though I never saw him, I think I met him in the store that night. I think he was whispering in my ear advice about Chad Everett and an invitation to dinner. And between mangoes and a way out, in a blinding spark of darkness, he told me that the light I was looking for was somewhere beyond the Pepsis. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, that was a terrible day. Terrible day. There's a little time if there anyone have any questions, and then if anyone wants a book, I would be more than happy to sign it for you. Yes, sir. Yes. I'll repeat the question here is that I had scenes that were cut out of did I have scenes cut out of the Spike Jonze's movie adaptation? I had some really hilarious scenes in that movie. At least I thought they were. I played the forest ranger. Adaptation was a movie that took place about finding orchids, and I played a forest ranger who was an expert of the Okeechobee Swamp, wherever it was. And my lingo in that was everything I did had to be precise. Everything I said had to be precise. So, well, the Okeechobee Swamp is about 4 billion years old. Well, 4.3 billion. Well, some people say 4.5 billion, but it's probably more like 4.1 billion. And it's about 19 miles long and 4 miles wide. Well, actually 20 miles long and 5.5. And of course, Nicolas Cage is listening to all this, which is just like with deadpan. I thought it was all very funny. But I shot 3 scenes. I didn't see the movie, so I don't know if all the scenes were cut. I had a scene with Meryl Streep where she shoots me in the head. And it was really delightful. There were a couple actresses I would put my life in their hands, and Meryl Streep was one because she was shooting a gun that shot blanks from about 3 feet from behind my head. So that could have killed me if she actually hit me. But she said, you know, she aimed at a spot where they told her to hit, to where the blank would hit it and bounce away from me, and she hit it every take. Every take she hit that spot. And it was wonderful meeting her on that film. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You've had a lot of work and some great stuff, and you've been very good. What would you say would be the thing you worked on that was most enjoyable to you?
This is a great question. The question is, what have I worked on that's the most enjoyable? And it all depends on how you define the word enjoyable. Certainly the most rewarding thing I ever worked on was Groundhog Day. That was absolutely a brilliant script with a brilliant cast, wonderful directing. I had a great part in it, and it was really delightful to work on that show. But the most fun I ever had on any show had to be Great Balls of Fire. It was the one show that Dennis Quaid playing Jerry Lee Lewis and Winona Ryder playing his little cousin that he marries. But it was the first job I ever had that I had a run-of-the-picture deal. And what that means is they give run-of-the-picture deals to big stars, and they give it to small fries, too, that it's just easier to keep them in Memphis and not have them go back and forth. We don't have to pay for plane tickets. So I was signed on for 2.5 months in Memphis and then a month in London doing that film, and I worked almost the least of anybody on that show. So I worked once every 12 days, we figured out. And the producers were going to give me some kind of award for actually being in Memphis the most and working the least. So what I did was I went to jazz clubs, blues bars. I ate barbecue. I hung out with the fabulous Thunderbirds. Jimmy Vaughn and I went to Kiva Recordings, and we laid down recordings after he did that. I ran into my old friend Stevie Ray Vaughan, and we reminisced some about the old days when we were in high school together. This little girl here, Anne Hearn and I, we got married during that show. So that was a lot of fun. And I was learning to play golf, so I played golf at that time. So I had a lot of fun doing that show. But that show didn't turn out to be enormously successful. But it was still delightful. Yes, sir. What part did I play in Great Balls of Fire? I played Judd Phillips, who was Sam Phillips's brother. I was Jerry Lee Lewis's manager. So Judd Phillips was his engineer. He ran Sun Studios, and I was his manager. So that's why I got to go to London. I tell you, it is not a fun experience. It was absolutely stunning experience is that during that film, one of the last scenes we shot in Memphis was a phone call between Trey Wilson and myself. We were brothers. And so we were going to do his part of the phone call in America, and then we were going to shoot my part in London. So I was off camera for him to do my lines, and he did his lines. He was packing up. He was off to go do the Coen Brothers film, Miller's Crossing. He had a starring role in Miller's Crossing. So I still had one more day in Memphis. And so what happened was I'm going to do one more load of laundry. Trey is leaving. His plan was to go to Kiva Recording because he had promised his wife, always, that he would record every song he had ever written in his life. And he was going to leave it at Kiva Recordings, then go to do Miller's Crossing, and then go back to New York to be with his wife for a weekend, then come back and start shooting. And then on the weekends, he would drive back and forth from New Orleans to Memphis to finish the recordings. I get a phone call before going to London from Ricky Stein, our accountant on Great Balls of Fire. I figured she was going to tell me all the flight plans of going to London. She's in tears. Trey is dead. Trey died of a cerebral hemorrhage while he went to New York. First scene up when I'm in London is my half of the scene with Trey. And Jim McBride said, we were going to show you the video that we have of Trey. Is that going to affect you? I said, I would love seeing Trey. It's fine with me if I see Trey. Everybody on the crew is crying. I do my half of the scene. Dennis says we're going to have a memorial for Trey afterwards. We go upstairs to the hotel in London, and we're all telling Trey stories. We call his wife from New York, and this was back in the old days with no cell phones. So it's one of those conference call kind of things. The phone is on the floor. And we share all of our stories with Trey with her. She's in tears on the phone. And then she says, the one regret I always have is that Trey was a great songwriter, and no one will ever hear his songs. And I said, you don't know. And I realized I was the only person who knew because I was going to do my laundry when Trey was going out to the car. Hey, John. When Trey was going out to the car, I said, Trey has recorded all of his songs. They're in a box at Kiva Recording. If you go to Kiva Recording in Memphis, all of the recordings, and he recorded them for you because he was going to give them to you as a gift for your... She flew to Memphis, and all of the songs Trey wrote were in a box, had been recorded. She picked them up and thanked me. And it just made me realize that we never know in our lives when we're the one person who's carrying the one piece of information that can make the world change for somebody else. So it wasn't a funny story about Great Balls of Fire, but it's another reason why that was a significant, significant show for me. Yes, sir.
Jerry Lee Lewis, or his first wife, show up on the...
Yes, sir. Jerry Lee did with a gun. Did Jerry Lee Lewis show up with on that show? Yes, he did. He showed up with, I think, his fourth wife, maybe, not his first. And I spent a lot of time with Jerry Lee. And he's brilliant, one of the most brilliant people in the world. It's a matter of, what is it, nurture and nature? Nurture and nature. The people in Memphis regard Jerry Lee Lewis as a freak of nature, of one of the great musical geniuses of all time. And what one jazz saxophonist told me is, Jerry Lee Lewis grew up in the red light districts of Louisiana, hog farms. That was his background. That's why he played honky-tonk piano. If he grew up in the courts of Vienna, he would be Franz Liszt. He is probably the greatest technical pianist that anyone has ever seen. I saw Jerry Lee Lewis playing on a piano in a lobby of a hotel that said, "Do not play." And I recognized him like, that's Jerry Lee Lewis. He's playing the piano. He was playing Lady of Spain. And then he shifted. And with one hand, he was playing Lady of Spain. And then he started playing Führer Liszt by Beethoven with the other hand. Both in different keys, different time signatures. Then he melded them both together into some kind of jazz piece and ended up playing Lady of Spain. And ended up getting up laughing and walking out into the street. Jerry Lee Lewis is one of the true great American musical geniuses. An amazing character. Amazing character. Yes?
How did the Dangerous Animals Club become the title, the focus of the book? There's so many great stories. How did you zero in on that?
That was with the help of Ben Lonan, my editor in New York. It was his favorite story in the book. And he said, you know, it's a great title for a book. And then Ann and I were talking about it. And we realized that a lot of the stories in the book are about all the dangerous animals I met in my life, including the guy in the store. I mean, he's a dangerous animal. And some of the people I've met on movie sets, besides people in my life, animals in my life, all sorts of things. So it seemed to capture the theme of the book. I guess if you would say, what is the theme of all the stories in this arc of stories? It's about the beginnings of things. And it's about surviving catastrophe, which we all have to do to get to our ripe old age, you know, because that Grim Reaper, he'd be waiting around the corner. But that's kind of what this group of stories is about. So we got that. Well, very good. Thank you all very, very much. If anyone wants a book...
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.